It's Twin Bills, the Red Sox podcast from the sports department of the Providence Journal, featuring Red Sox beat writer Bill Koch, along with sports editor Bill Corey. Now, Twin Bills.
Hello and welcome to the World Series edition of the Twin Bills podcast. That has a nice ring to it, doesn't it, Bill? It
certainly does.
I'm Bill Corey, sports editor of the Providence Journal, and with me in downtown Providence is a travel-weary Red Sox writer, Bill Koch. Bill, how are you feeling these days?
Feeling okay. You know that there's only seven games left of the seven most important games of the year. If you can't get up for the World Series, then you're probably in the wrong industry.
Right, right. And it may not be seven games.
May not.
Could be four. Could be five. So since we last spoke, a lot has happened. The biggest thing that's happened is the Red Sox dispatched the Houston Astros in a mere five games, winning the series 4-1. Wow!
Wow, I was right. It was a surprise to me too.
Yeah. So let's talk about that a little bit, and then obviously talk about what's going to be beginning at Fenway Park on Tuesday night, and that is the World Series against the Los Angeles Dodgers. But, boy, that Houston series, I thought it was going to last a little longer. I thought the Houston Astros were going to figure out how to win because I think as we looked at both teams, I think we both agreed that, you know, the Astros probably seemed better, at least on paper, in just about all the categories. Not that the Red Sox were bad, obviously, but it didn't play out that way, and it was a convincing series victory by the Red Sox, who are at this point steamrolling through the playoffs.
Yeah, they kind of did everything right, whether it was getting good starting pitching at the right time, having some key performances out of the bullpen, and getting contributions up and down the lineup. And really, you know, I say that and I start thinking to myself, this is what they've done all season. They're just doing it now in the playoffs.
Yeah.
And it's even more impressive when you consider the caliber of opponent, the pressure of the moment, the fact that they've been able to go 5-0 on the road in Yankee Stadium and in Minute Maid Park.
Yeah, it's been
very impressive.
Absolutely impressive. So let's touch on a few of the highlights from the Astros here. First of all, Jackie Bradley Jr. Only had I think three hits in that series, but they were three big ones: a grand slam, a two-run home run, a double, I want to say, early in the series. What did you make of JBJ's production? Was it a surprise to you? Because it was obviously game-changing.
To get that sort of thunder out of the nine spot in the order isn't something that you would expect. But like I said earlier, it's just one of those things where these guys have been able to contribute. Everyone who's been on the field for the Red Sox this season has given them something, from Mookie Betts all the way down to someone like Tony Renda, you know, who played in one game and scored a run that beat the Yankees.
Right. Or Brandon Phillips.
You know, I mean, it's just... And that's how you win the way that they've won. You look back on it now, they've won 115 games this year. If they win the World Series, they're going to have won 119 games, which is phenomenal, to say the least. You know, I think back to some of those dynasty Yankee teams. You know, there was one year in there in the 90s where they won 125 games and won the World Series. And you just think about the magnitude of that number. The fact that you're able to do that to fellow professionals over 6 or 7 month period, it's fantastic. You know, and in Bradley's case, a guy who a lot of people had buried mid-season, you know, wanted him gone, wanted him out of the lineup, wanted Alex Cora to quit on him. You know, was hitting 178 in the middle of June.
Yeah, I'm raising my hand because I was among that crowd early in the season, and you know, obviously they kept him in there because they had so much production elsewhere. But on a normal team, you know, somebody who was with that kind of production doesn't usually start.
No, and it made total sense at the time. Now, you know, realistically, I didn't think that they had great alternatives. I did not want JD Martinez playing right field every night.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that would have moved Mookie Betts over to center. I felt like, you know, just let Bradley go. He's playing good defense. And more importantly, you're winning. So he's not preventing you from winning games yet. So you let it play out. And, you know, credit to him, the way that he worked on his swing, the way that Alex Cora managed him, you know, sort of showed great patience and great faith. And that was rewarded at the most critical time. You know, he comes up in game three in a 4-2 game with Roberto Osuna leaking oil. And in my mind, one of the biggest swings of the series, he hits a grand slam to right field. And when you go up 8-2 at that point, you realize you're going to take home field advantage back.
Sure.
And, you know, I won't say that the next two games would have been a bonus if the Red Sox could have won them. But I know Cora's stated goal going down there was winning one game and getting the series back to Fenway Park. And I think that might have given them a sort of freedom the next two nights to be able to do what they did.
Maybe they exhaled a little bit and say, okay, we did what Skipper wanted us to do. But boy, it really was remarkable, and particularly in Jackie Bradley's case. I mean, he's got a 371 OBP here in the postseason. And as you mentioned earlier before we started recording, he's taking a lot of walks. And, you know, when he hit that home run, that, to me, the first thing that flashed in my mind was J.D. Drew from 07. You know?
Oh, wow, yeah.
You know, now, obviously, Drew didn't have the as bad a year, but, you know, there was certainly a lot of negativity about J.D. Drew, and then he hits that big grand slam and helps turn around the ALCS. And in this case, Jackie Bradley, you know, just put that game out of reach and ultimately helped them go on and win the series. And I guess the other star, if you want to point to stars of the series, because they weren't the typical stars, certainly not on offense.
No.
I mean, Mookie has been okay, but not great, and Martinez hasn't. You know, he hit that home run against the Yankees, and
also homer against Verlander
and
homer in against, Game 5.
Right, and yep. Verlander, right. And I mean, he's got a, you know, 313 postseason average and 415 on base, so he's certainly doing okay. But, you know, he's certainly not as eye-popping as JBJ. But the other star was David Price in the Game 5 win. 6 innings, no runs, 9 Ks. Finally gets that. I had a friend of mine on, I think it was Facebook, somewhere on social media, saying something like, that giant thud you heard was King Kong falling off of David Price's back, because, boy, he must have just slept great that night.
Yeah, it was, you know, it was really the perfect scenario for him to make a start, honestly. You're up 3-1 in the series.
Yeah.
He's on short rest, so not much is really expected of him. You know, the talk going into that with Alex Cora was maybe as few as 12 outs would have been acceptable. Mm. He would have liked David Price to get through 4 innings, 5 innings. You know, just sort of save the rest of the bullpen so that they could take the next off day and then maybe go into Game 6 and fight again. Mm-hmm. But the way he threw the ball against Houston, it just spoke to, you know, a sort of freedom that he had, I think, mentally, being in that spot up 3-1 with no real expectations. The thing about Price, I think, and you could almost sense it the night before, he was in the clubhouse and he had his son Xavier with him.
Yeah.
And he spoke to the media for probably about 10 minutes. And, you know, he's in one of the best moods that I've seen him in all year. And I think it's important to note with Price that the last two seasons, there were times where, you know, he sort of had the cone of silence around him.
Right.
You know, it was sort of got the vibe that he wasn't going to be very approachable and wasn't too happy to be there. This season, he's changed that for the most part. I think he's been welcoming and, you know, a little bit more outgoing. You know, certainly had better interactions with media members this season. You know, and the best one was probably the other night. He just seemed very loose, very calm, very relaxed. And I think with Price, the ability has never been in question.
Right.
It's been the mental side that you've wondered about, whether or not he could perform in a big playoff game in a big pressure spot like that. And for him to go out and put up the line that he did, no walks and 9 strikeouts, no Red Sox starter had ever done that in a postseason game. Had never struck out as many as 9 guys and walked 9 in a postseason start. And the stuff itself was fantastic. You're talking about running up a fastball to 96 miles an hour. He threw his second and third hardest pitches of the season on short rest after however many starts he made in the regular season and in the postseason, throwing changeups down and away that are dipping under bats.
You could absolutely tell he had his command and he had confidence in his command.
He was locked in. That's what it looks like when great ability meets confidence. Mm. That's what it looked like for six innings.
Yeah. And it came at a great time, obviously, because I think it renewed a lot of people's faith in Price now that they're moving on to the World Series.
What you just hope is that this might unlock something for him, that he can go out against the Dodgers and have another good start. And he's not going to have the 1 2/3 innings, 10 batters that he had against the Yankees, his first postseason start.
Right.
You're hoping that what he's done here is raised the floor so that even if he has a quote-unquote bad outing against the Dodgers, it's like 5 1/3,
yeah,
where he gives up, you know, 3 earned runs or something like that.
What I'm hoping for really is that he can just go out and pitch and not worry about, oh, that old line that it, you know, you haven't won in the postseason. Like, you know, just forget about all that now. I mean,
he alluded to that. He said, I look forward to the fact that I'm not going to have to answer that question anymore.
Yeah, and good for him. I mean, he went out and threw a great, and that's really what he had to do, and he did it. You know, and the other, I guess the other person I want to touch upon here before we leave the Astros to their winter golf is Craig Kimbrell, the closer, who certainly had his struggles throughout this postseason. But I got to tell you, on that closeout game, he looked damn good. He looked like the Craig Kimbrell from earlier this year. Now you have written and others have that, you know, that maybe they found out what the problem was, that maybe he was tipping some of his pitches. I don't know if that's true or not. I guess maybe that was the case, but he looked like a different guy on Friday night. He looked like the Craig Kimbrell we were sort of used to seeing before the last 6 weeks of the season.
Yeah, some of the video evidence would seem to support that he might have been, in fact, tipping his pitches. Alex Cora got a text message from a friend from Montreal, as he put it, Eric Gagne, his former Dodgers and Red Sox teammate.
Right, that would be the biggest save that Gagne ever contributed to the Red Sox if that's true.
That's been the running joke the last 3 or 4 days. And it certainly is true in this case. Apparently, Gagne was watching Game 4 and noticed, you know, that Kimbrell might have been different coming to the plate, whether it be with his fastball or with his breaking ball.
His set was a little different, or the way he was sort of coming, approaching the plate with his pitch was a little different.
There was a good breakdown on a Twitter page called Pitching Ninja, which if folks are into, you know, just sort of like nasty stuff, whether it be a great cut fastball or a great curveball or hitters looking really bad, you know, Pitching Ninja has great breakdowns in GIF form. And a lot of times you'll see, you know, sort of movement on pitches. And it's a guy by the name of Rob Friedman. He's an Atlanta-based pitching coach. And what he'll do is what they call overlays. He'll overlay a fastball over a breaking ball. And you'll see the difference between how a pitch looks 30 feet out of the pitcher's hand and then what it does the last 30 feet. And it really does a good job of illustrating how difficult it is to hit major league pitching. And in Kimbrell's case, you could see the set position with the breaking ball. His hands were a little tighter to his beard. Hmm. He had his hands up close to his face. And also on the fastball, his head was picking up the target a little sooner than the breaking ball. He was looking to the plate sooner. So his fix for that going into Game 5 was he put his hands down to the belt for every pitch. And apparently his head positioning was a little bit more consistent. And, you know, like Alex Cora said, he struck out 2 of the 4 guys he faced in Game 5. Didn't really look in any trouble at any point.
He walked the guy, right?
He had a walk.
Yeah.
And Tony Kemp flew out to left center to end the game. But it was more like the Craig Kimbrell who finished a regular season holding opponents scoreless in 13 out of his last 15 appearances. It was much less like the Craig Kimbrell who you'd seen through his first 4 playoff outings.
Right. It's amazing how subtle those changes are, those differences are, right? Because most people would look at that and say, oh, it looks the same to me, but it just shows you how well-tuned those batters' eyes are. They can pick up things like that. Oh, look, the glove is 2.5 inches away from his beard instead of, you know, 1.5 inches away from his beard.
It never ceases to amaze me what these guys can pick up off a bench, whether it be picking up signs or picking up tendencies or body language. And now with the advent of video the way it is, the fact that everything is digital and you can watch things literally between innings, you know, in a room underneath the dugout, there really are no secrets. If a runner is relaying signs or a pitcher is tipping, you're going to be found out very quickly. And as you know, Bill, these guys are so good. They only need a little advantage to get through.
Absolutely. Yeah, the difference between greatness and goodness is kind of razor thin at that level. Moving on now to the World Series, which still seems crazy to say because I didn't think the Red Sox would get there this year, even though they won 108 games, but I just thought the Astros were a better team. The World Series opens Tuesday night at Fenway Park against the historic Los Angeles Dodgers. And, you know, I'm a World Series guy, Bill. You can ask my daughters about, you know, just kind of the nerdy things that I like to spout about the World Series. You know, I was able to, I can't do it now, but last year I was able to give you every World Series winner dating back to 1972, you know?
Wow, good for
you. Yeah, I mean, most of them because I actually remember the World Series, not because I actually memorized the list, but...
Oh, I like this.
But
good.
But the World Series to me is always just, it's just a special kind of event.
It is.
You know, it's not, you know, the Super Bowl's great, it's a great party, but, you know, football as a sport, you know, you can't play a series, or if you do, it would take a month, you know.
Right.
You know, to me, a World Series really does show that who the better team is, you know, and there's so many things, there's so much drama that goes into it. Can a guy come back on short rest? And sometimes there are heroes that step up that you know, normally wouldn't be great players during the regular season. So I'm just excited to be able to watch the series, obviously rooting for the Red Sox to win, but just rooting for a great World Series overall. So in this World Series against the Dodgers, and we'll talk about the Dodgers in a minute here, there are some questions going in that I want to pick your brain about. These are the things that have been in the news in the last couple of days. The first thing is the health of Chris Sale. Now, Alex Cora said Chris Sale will be his game one starter Tuesday night in Boston against the Dodgers. The last we heard of Chris Sale, he was leaving the hospital after some kind of a stomach ailment, joined the team a little late, joked that it was about, you know, he had a belly button ring or something that was infected, which was a total joke. But now I fully believe that Chris Sale is as healthy as he's going to be to make this start. I don't think they would rush him out there if he needed another couple of days. What's your take on it?
Well, first, if you believe that Chris Sale had an infected navel piercing, then I have a bridge to sell you in Brooklyn. You've been taken.
Yeah.
You know, and you could be taken by anyone. You know, allow me to come and con you at your leisure,
right,
if you wish.
Right.
You know, I'll send you an email from Nigeria asking me.
Oh, that was you?
That was me.
Oh.
Asking you to wire your bank account number to me because I'm being held hostage, right, and whatever else. That common email phishing scheme.
You know, at first when you hear that, you know, it takes a minute or two to kind of figure out that he's joking. But at first when you hear it, my first reaction was, really? I didn't think. Because you think of somebody with a navel ring as maybe just like a different kind of dude, you know. It just doesn't strike you that Chris Sale would have a navel ring.
No.
I mean, I don't know. I've never seen his navel. I don't know. But
Chris Sale was sick. He had some kind of 24-hour bug. He checked himself into Mass General Hospital. And if you know anything about the guy and you've paid attention to him all season, you know how much he hates missing games,
yeah,
and hates missing starts. And so you magnify that and multiply it because it's the postseason. And he has to miss starts. And not only that, but, you know, he wasn't great in game one.
Right.
So he didn't get another chance to go back out there. You know, he for the last 2 months of the year, when his workload was limited by the shoulder inflammation, he looked like a caged tiger in the clubhouse.
Oh, yeah.
He just wanted to be let out.
Absolutely.
You know, and so you turn that to the postseason stage and you tell him that he can't pitch, and it's that much worse. You know, so he's very much looking forward to taking the ball in game one. He was speaking about that Sunday, and he said it's a dream. It's what we all dream about growing up playing baseball, you know, being able to pitch or play in the World Series. You know, he's probably about as healthy as he's going to be. He's had extended rest here. He's had a chance to throw a couple bullpens, so, you know, if there are anything, any, you know, lingering mechanical issues that he might have, particularly from the Yankee series where he couldn't find his slider in his start, he might have been able to iron those out a little bit. You know, and I expect the full Chris Sale experience, you know, in game one. Maybe not the guy who's throwing 98, 99 miles an hour in the middle of the season, but certainly a guy who can go out there and get some people out.
I do too. And again, if they needed, if he needed another day or two, you know, I would say, well, why not just give it to him? And, you know, if he pitches game three, he could pitch game seven if you need him to. So I don't see the Red Sox rushing him out to the mound if they don't, if they weren't confident.
No.
The other question that I want to ask you about is who's going to pitch game two?
Yeah, Alex Cora didn't commit to that in his Sunday remarks. I wonder if he'll be a little bit more expansive here today on Monday after we tape this. The interesting thing about that is you got to start looking at the weather a little bit. And you wonder if you want David Price to go out there and pitch in the cold. As he said earlier in the year, he does have some circulatory problems where his hands and feet are susceptible to being, you know, a little cold in the tough weather here in New England. And you know, you wonder if you'd rather have Nathan Eovaldi start game two. He's pretty much on full rest. His relief stint aside, he's had enough time off from his last start in game three against Houston. Whether or not you might want to have him start game two and have Price start game three in warm, sunny Los Angeles, where it's going to be 80 degrees every day the Red Sox are there.
Right. And in Boston, for the next two nights, we're looking at temperatures probably in the 40s or even maybe in the 30s, high 30s, you know. So, that's sort of my take on it, too. You know, why not push Price back to a game out in Los Angeles when you're not going to have to, presumably not really going to have to deal with bad weather. He's somebody who has obviously shown that he has a problem or could have a problem in cold weather. And I think that's probably why Alex Cora hasn't definitively come out and said, here's who's going to, you know, who's going to pitch. He's probably weighing the same things. it might have to do with how they do in game one. You know, if they win the game, does he feel a little bit better about going with one guy over another versus if they lose the game? So we'll see. He doesn't have to commit until after game one, or when do you have to name the next day starter?
Realistically, it's after game one at some point. The other thing is Cora could be expecting a long grinding series, and maybe he wants Eovaldi in game seven.
Yeah.
Maybe he's looking that far ahead. The thing about managers and baseball staffs is you get into these series and you think about what Cora had to say on Sunday. Part of having an early workout was to let the players go, let them enjoy their Sunday, probably watch some football, relax with their families a little bit. The other part is the coaching staff stayed at Fenway Park and had meetings.
Right.
Meetings with their advanced scouts, meetings with their analytics teams. And they're going to do that again on Monday. These are going to be two of the longest days of the year for that coaching staff, for Cora, for Dana Lavangie, for Tim Hyers, for Andy Barquette, for Brian Bannister. Those guys are going to be locked in a room with Dave Dombrowski and the analytics team going over who they want on the 25-man roster, what lineups they should play, how they should use the pitching staff. They'll be breaking down the Dodgers and, you know, the guys that they sort of want to target and the guys that they sort of want to stay away from in their lineup and, you know, the pitchers who they think that they can get to in certain matchups. So, you know, just the amount of preparation that goes into something like this, it's not as simple as Cora just saying, well, this guy's going to start game two and this guy's going to start game three because it's their turn.
Right.
It's a lot more thinking that goes into it, and the weather is certainly something that they're going to discuss. They leave no stone unturned.
You mentioned Nathan Eovaldi, and we probably shouldn't just ignore how well he's done here. We were talking about some of the stars in Houston. Boy, he's been a fantastic postseason pitcher for them, giving them another weapon both as a starter and as a reliever. I remember when they got him, I was thinking, you know, he'll be sort of a good fourth man and maybe he'll be in the bullpen in the postseason, who knows. But, man, he's on the front lines, isn't he?
Yeah, I think that's what everyone saw for him. And I just wonder if the Red Sox have maybe given him a certain approach or, maybe sort of allowed him to attack hitters in a different way than he was in Tampa. I'm not certain of that. And, he wouldn't say that because he wouldn't want to disrespect the coaching staff in Tampa in any way. But the way he threw the ball in Game 3, certainly, and Steve Pierce's contribution in Game 3, that was a great night for Dave Dombrowski.
Because
he made additions at the trade deadline that maybe weren't necessarily the most popular popular editions.
They weren't the I think we used the word stop the presses. They weren't the stop the presses editions for sure.
People wanted Zach Britton. People wanted Ryan Pressly. They wanted a bullpen arm. Mm-hmm. And what Dombrowski got was a right-handed starting pitcher who theoretically could shift to the bullpen for the playoffs, and a first baseman who could hit left-handed pitching. And, mm-hmm. and they identify that as a weakness. The fact that Pierce has been so good with Mitch Moreland battling this hamstring injury has just been a bonus. And, you know, I just look at those two guys coming in particular in Game 3 against Houston. And when you make these trades at the deadline, you hope, you envision, best-case scenario, that these guys can do something like that in October. And, boy, did they come through there.
Absolutely. You're right. It was a good night and a good postseason so far, really, for Dave Dombrowski. And I think, Alex Bregman's little trolling probably didn't hurt either, although Evaldi took the high road. You know, I didn't see it. I really didn't pay attention to it. But, you know, I still don't understand why professional athletes do that, because, you know, I get that, you know, hey, these are young guys and sometimes they're having fun and stuff, but, you know, why give the opponent, you know, more incentive to want to beat you?
Well, here's what I wonder about. Okay, the Red Sox are generally, you know, sort of placid group of guys.
Yeah.
There's not really anyone out there on Front Street sort of, you know, making a big deal of themselves in the media or saying anything controversial. But they won 108 games this year. Why do you want to poke the bear?
Yeah,
if you're Aaron Judge and you want to walk out of Fenway Park with New York playing, and if you're Alex Bregman and you want to troll Nathan Eovaldi by, you know, posting on Instagram the back-to-back-to-back home runs that Houston hit off him in June,
right?
Why do you want to do that?
Yeah.
You know, you've already got their full attention. You already have the attention of the best team in baseball during the regular season, by record anyway. Houston obviously had a better WAR and a better run differential, but why do you want to wake them up even more than they already might be? The old rule, there was a pitcher, way back in the 20s and the 30s, and his name escapes me at this point, but he had a rule about facing Lou Gehrig and Babe Ruth. And he would brush back Babe Ruth. Had no problems doing that because he felt like Babe Ruth was just out there anyway.
Yeah.
But his rule on Lou Gehrig was do not do it because he's one of the nicest guys in the league and you probably don't want to wake him up. Because if you do, he's going to be impossible to get out.
Right, right.
You know, you don't want him not only locked in but angry at the same time. And I look at the Red Sox now and I'm thinking, you know, this is kind of nice, placid, polite group of guys.
Yeah.
But they won 108 games. You don't do that by accident. So why do you want to poke them?
Yeah.
Makes no sense whatsoever.
Yeah, no, it just struck me as one of these things that I'm sure if Alex Bregman could go back in time and do something differently, he probably would. But, you're in the ALCS. You're on the biggest stage at that point. You know, you've got their full attention. They've got your full attention. Go out and play baseball, you know. Anyway, it was as a Red Sox fan, it was good to see that Eovaldi got his revenge the right way, basically just beating them. So the other question that I want to talk to you about before the World Series starts, and this really won't take effect until the series shifts to sunny Los Angeles, is the whole no DH in the National League and what that does to the Red Sox lineup. And there has been some talk and some stories written about the possibility of shifting Mookie Betts to second base so you can keep his bat, JBJ's bat, JD Martinez's bat, who obviously would be then playing in the outfield, and Benintendi's bat all in the lineup. So what's your take on it?
Well, this is the blessing and the curse of having a good DH. You have JD Martinez. You obviously want his bat in the order. I think back to 2004 when you had David Ortiz, who was pretty much your primary designated hitter. Mm-hmm. You had him play first base in St. Louis. You put Kevin Millar on the bench. In this case, though, you have JD Martinez, who is an outfielder by trade, who would put the best defensive right fielder in the game on the bench in Mookie Betts. That's certainly not going to happen. So you wonder how you can fit Betts into the lineup, and the natural spot to put him at would be at second base. He was drafted as an infielder, played in the infield, you know, in his minor league career, all the way up through Pawtucket, actually, before he converted to the outfield.
Mm-hmm.
Is a guy who takes ground balls at second base pretty much every day in batting practice. Now, he says it's to keep his hands quick. And if you think back to Game 4, the play he made at the start of the eighth inning on the Tony Kemp single down the line in right field, picked up the ball, turned, and without really looking at second base, made a real quick transfer and throw and gunned down Tony Kemp, who's a very fast runner.
And threw a perfect strike to second base. I mean, it had to be right where it was for them to get Kemp out.
And that's the type of play that if you have a runner at first and there's a ground ball hit to the second baseman's left, what does he do? Fields the ball on his glove side, pivots, and throws to second base without really looking.
Right.
You know, he just trusts where the bag is, where the shortstop's going to be, mm-hmm. and he makes that play, and right. it either starts a double play or it gets a force out.
Yeah.
That's just muscle memory for a guy like Mookie Betts,
sure.
and he's done it all the way along. What you wonder is how he handles the plays around the bag,
right.
how he's going to turn double plays, you know, how that's going to affect their bunt coverages, because he hasn't done that in a long time. You get into the National League Park, it stands to reason that the pitcher will be sacrificing, you know, or the guys at the bottom of the order will be bunting, or trying to put runners in motion. So can you get him up to speed on the bunt coverages, when the Dodgers hit and run, when you're turning double plays and, you know, it's a ground ball to the left side of the infield and he's the guy who actually has to catch and make the throw and avoid the runner coming in, because that could expose him to injury, potentially.
Right. Right.
It's a small chance, but it is a chance, and he's your leadoff guy and one of your best offensive players. So all those things are going to come into consideration for Alex Cora. You know, the realistic thing that they would do if this was a regular season game was they would play Martinez, they would move Betts to center field, and they would give either Bradley or Benintendi a night off.
Right.
That's not really an option in the World Series. So more and more I think about it, they really could do this.
Mm.
I really think that they might end up doing this.
Yeah, and I think that they will, and I hope that they do, and I'd be in favor of it for a couple of reasons. Number one, you know, Jackie Bradley has been one of your hottest hitters, and I would do what I could to keep his bat and his legs in the lineup.
Well, and his glove.
And
his,
well, obviously, and his glove, obviously.
Yeah, you need that.
That goes without saying, sure. Secondly, you know, Mookie Betts is such a unique player. You know, it's not like you're asking somebody who really is unfamiliar with a position to give it a shot. I mean, this is somebody, as you said, who has played second base right up through his minor league career through Pawtucket. So it's not something that is so foreign to him. And I would say, you know, try it, and if it looks like he's, you know, has trouble turning the double play, or then you know, okay, then you bench Bradley or you bench Benintendi, whatever, you bench somebody, you put Mookie back out in the outfield and you use, you know, Brock Holt or Ian Kinsler at second or whatever. But, you know, I think that, you know, what Alex Cora does is he puts, not only does he put the team in a position to win, but he's able to identify the strengths of players and play to those strengths. And if you have a unique player like Mookie Betts, who has many strengths, and one of his strengths is versatility, I think Alex Cora could take advantage of that in the National League ballpark. You know, who knows? You know, maybe they're up 2 games to nothing when they go out there, and maybe Cora feels, well, you know, we're winning 2 games to nothing, and you know, I'd rather keep a better defensive alignment. But I would not be surprised to see Mookie starting at second base in Los Angeles in Game 3.
The one thing that Cora did say and was unequivocal about is that J.D. Martinez is going to play.
Sure, absolutely.
He's going to play all 3 games in Los Angeles, and he will be in the lineup at somebody else's expense. You know, and if you do this and you start the game this way, we spoke about this before we came on the podcast, you get into the late innings, let's say you have the lead, or you start, you know, changing pitchers and that spot in the lineup comes up. You have a natural defensive replacement and moves to make in terms of shifting Mookie Betts back to right field, bringing in Ian Kinsler at second base, and having someone hit in the pitcher spot.
Yeah.
You've got a natural double switch option that creates. You don't like losing Martinez's bat in the order. You'd only like to do that if you have the lead.
If you have the lead and it's late, and you're not going to be sacrificing too many at-bats.
And the other thing you wonder about is do you want to make it a true double switch? Like, let's say Martinez hits in the seventh for the fourth time, and the inning ends two batters after his spot. Theoretically, if you're up, let's say, 4-1 in the game, the true double switch at that point would be you bring in a pitcher. Let's say it's Matt Barnes in the eighth inning, and he goes into the third spot in the order, which would be Martinez's spot. You bring in Kinsler into the pitcher's spot in the order, which would be nine, because theoretically he could hit in the ninth inning.
Right.
Cora could choose to say, we're going to maintain some lineup continuity here. We don't necessarily want, if the bullpen melts down for some reason, or if we have a huge rally in the ninth inning or whatever.
Right. You don't want Craig Kimbrell up there in the three spot.
Well,
right?
We don't want the pitcher in the middle of the order,
maybe
we're just going to keep him in the nine hole.
Yeah.
That's another thing that they're going to have to consider, of course. But if they do this, you're going to have natural defensive replacements. It's going to be moves that Cora can make without really having to think.
Yeah.
Even if it's a very tight, intense game, he'll just be able to sort of pull the switch and say, all right, Kinsler, go to second base. Betts, go to right field. JD, stay in here.
Mm-hmm.
That's very easy. You know, that's something that you can talk about before the game. It's not exactly revolutionary.
Right.
But it certainly is a very interesting topic. And, you know, it is a bit of a risk to take. But more days go by, the more I'm able to convince myself that they probably should.
Hmm. Right. Well, we'll see. We'll see in a few more days. So we would be remiss here if we don't touch upon the opponent that the Red Sox are going to be playing in the World Series, and that is the Los Angeles Dodgers. Historic franchise, obviously had its roots in Brooklyn, moved out to L.A. in the late 50s. So unlike a lot of National League teams, the Dodgers are, you know, legit. I mean, they've got a really good lineup. The odds makers in Vegas give the Red Sox the favorite, but not by much. They're slight favorites.
Sure.
And if you look at the Dodgers lineup, you know, it's not your typical slap hit speed kind of small ball that you think of when you think of some National League teams. You've got seven hitters on that team who have at least 20 home runs. You've got Cody Bellinger, and you've got Jock Peterson, and you've got Puig, and you've got Max Muncy, who came over. So you've got a real, power threat of a lineup. And then obviously, when you look at the pitching staff, you have a couple of studs there. You've got Clayton Kershaw, and then you've got Walker Buehler, and they have a closer with 38 saves and Kenley Jansen. So the Red Sox have typically done pretty well for themselves once they got to the World Series as of late. They swept the 2004 and 2007 World Series.
Correct.
And in 13...
Four games to two over.
Right, it was four games to two, so it really wasn't threatened. But, I think this is a seven-game series. Maybe six, but I think the Dodgers are a worthy foe.
Yeah, the Dodgers are more like an American League team than what they faced recently. I went back to 2004, 2007, and 2013, and just looked at the lineups that the Cardinals and the Rockies were rolling out. In particular, the Rockies in Game 1 of the 2007 World Series, Ryan Spielborgs was the DH.
Who?
Yeah, a career sort of fourth outfielder, pinch hitter type.
Right.
A designated hitter batting ninth in the American League Park against David Ortiz. So you automatically are starting off at a
you
huge
lose
disadvantage.
That one.
You lose
10 out of 10 times. Right?
If the Dodgers in game one elect to have, say, Yasiel Puig as the DH and they put Jock Peterson in the outfield, or they have Matt Kemp as the DH because Chris Sale is a left-handed pitcher.
Right.
You have guys who have been all-stars.
Sure.
Who are going to be your designated hitter. And guys who have hit 20-plus, 30-plus home runs in a season.
Yeah.
So legit bats there. Great lineup options for L.A. Obviously, you know, Cody Bellinger is one of the great young stars in the game, only 22 years old, potent from the left side. Manny Machado was one of the best pickups of the trade deadline.
Red we know Sox all about him.
Know
right?
all about him, yep. That's right. You know, Max Muncy has been a revelation this year, a guy who was with Oakland, yep. Sort of nondescript career to this point, hits 35 home runs this season. You know, it's a deep lineup. It's an experienced team. They were in the World Series last year. They took right. the Astros all the way to Game 7. They've won the NL West 6 years in a row. You know, and they have a great manager in Dave Roberts, someone who is very similar to Alex Cora in terms of demeanor, his positivity, the way he's been able to manipulate his roster throughout the year. Yeah. You know, Dave Roberts obviously will be very comfortable in Boston. As Alex Cora said on Sunday, he's a hero in this city and should be for what he did in 2004 in the American League Championship Series against the Yankees.
Sure. Greatest steal in the Red Sox history.
Yeah, right? As I wrote today, arguably the most famous stolen base in Red Sox history. Right.
Fortunately, they didn't have video review back then.
Well, no, he was safe. He was safe. You could.
It was close. He probably was safe.
Thankfully, but they made the right call on the field.
On the field, yeah.
You know, but obviously, a guy who has done a great job there. You know, in his spot as the manager,
yeah.
And you know, a formidable team, like you said, a worthy opponent. You know, and a team that. You know, wouldn't surprise anybody if they were able to go out and win the World Series.
Right, right.
Not at all.
So it should be a great World Series, a historic one. And it starts Tuesday night, a 2-3-2 format. So we have Tuesday and Wednesday in Boston. Thursday is the travel day. Friday, Saturday, Sunday in sunny LA. Obviously, Sunday if necessary. And then, if needed, Monday's the day off. They come back Tuesday and Wednesday of next week. Game 7 is on Halloween, Bill.
Mm.
So,
yeah.
Wonder what the temperatures will be like in lovely Fenway Park on October 31st.
Well,
but hey, that's why they call it the Fall Classic, right?
Well, let's hope that we don't have to find out, you know. But you think back to when the Red Sox were still trying to reverse the curse. If they were playing a Game 7 on Halloween... Could you imagine the headlines and the
man.
Sort of
right.
you know ghost references that would have been made then? We'd be looking at 100 years right now. this would be the 100-year anniversary
wow,
of the
curse.
That's
right, 1918 to
From 2018 to now.
Right, right.
If they were to play a Game 7 on Halloween, I mean, that pretty much would have been Armageddon
right.
If the Red Sox hadn't won a World Series by this point. And actually, you know, Los Angeles brings a pretty long drought into this. 30
right.
years
yeah.
since they've won the World Series.
Yeah.
And you think about the Dodgers and you associate the great tradition with them and obviously great history with them, but it's been a long time
yeah.
for them.
Yeah, 1988, that was the Oral Hershiser year, the Kirk Gibson year.
Yeah.
And obviously, you know, great history with that franchise as well. So, yeah, they've been waiting. And as you said, they've won, did you say, six NL West
six
titles
in a row, yeah.
in a row. So they've been at the door here. They've been right there knocking. So, you know, who knows if this is the year they finally get let in. I hope not. My feeling is the Red Sox figure out how to win this in a long series. But we will be there watching, reading, and, Bill, next time we do this, the Red Sox will either be fighting for their lives or will have been swept or will have won their, I guess, fourth World Series in this century.
Yes.
So I like their chances because they tend to do pretty well in the first 18 years of any century.
Very good. Very good reference.
Anyway, with that, we will close out this World Series edition of the Twin Bills podcast. Until next time, this is Bill Corey, and with me, Bill Koch. Thanks, Bill.
Thanks, Bill.